The Radio Today programme with Audioboo.
Thanks for downloading Radio Today's weekly podcast. I'm Trevor Dan, and in this edition, you'll hear some candid, even combative views on the BBC from two of Radio 4's senior presenters, Feedback's Roger Bolton and Laurie Taylor from Thinking Aloud. They were both attending a session this week organised by the Radio Independence Group to discuss the thorny issue of talent management or how radio producers can keep their presenters happy. Plenty of interesting observations were made. I think you'll enjoy the story of Top Gear's arsehole contracts, especially when I caught up with the panel afterwards. First, with Gloria Abramoff from Tonic Productions, here's the BBC Academy's Lucy Hooper.
As a producer, I hope what I'm doing is helping a presenter understand how they can speak, how they can appear in the best possible light for that particular listener or viewer. And we might have different opinions about that. We might have very different opinions about that. But I hope as a producer that I understand who my audience are. It's my job to find out who the audience are. And then to crucially get what we call in telly, and I'm sure you do this in radio as well, the tone right. Get the tone right. How can these presenters speak in the right way that is going to make that viewer, listener, engage emotionally and intellectually with the subject matter?
Glo, there's going to be some people listening to this who say, well, actually, I'm a radio presenter. I don't need the help of all these people who tell me that they know better than I do.
Yeah, well, good luck to those people, because that's so not true, and we know it.
You've worked with some pretty big character presenters like Vanessa and... Yeah. You know, Chris Evans.
I think I even produced Trevor Dan.
Steady.
Yeah. Big presenters.
How did you get the best out of them?
Oh, God. I had to build a relationship. They had to trust me. I had to pretend that I knew what I was doing a lot of the time. But you see, the thing is, I actually really enjoyed doing what I was doing. And so I think a lot of people just enjoyed working with me. I think I'm really good fun to work with. I think I'm a bit of a laugh.
So you bring the best out of the presenter.
I think I do. And I don't think I could have said this 10 years ago, but you know, I'm at a point now where I really do know what I'm doing. And I think I do bring out the best in people, and I'm not frightened because I just think, oh, what's the worst that could possibly happen? And also, I'm also quite good at not over-managing them. So if they're in meltdown, whereas 20 years ago, I would have colluded in the meltdown. Now I'm not prepared to do that. I'm also always looking for the presenter behind them. So if, you know, God forbid they're not very well, you know, who can step in? And they know that.
Roger Boltley is here, who presented the event this evening. Roger, as the presenter of Feedback, presumably you are the person who understands what it's like to have producers inflicted upon you.
Well, I am, yeah, but I think the difficulty is, I find often, is that you normally want to please your producer primarily. That's the first thing. I've got to please the listener. I mean, and to an extent, I'm their advocate, sometimes against the producers who's producing me. And it's quite a tricky role to locate yourself on the way. You know, I have to sort of stand on a bridge between the BBC and the audience. And sometimes when the producer or the company, understandably, wants to not offend the BBC, should we say that the contract's up there for renewal or whatever, sometimes you have to say, I'm sorry, this is what the listeners want me to ask. And of course, one of my difficulties is, having worked in broadcasting for a long time, I'm rather an opinionated person. I've got to be very careful. My own opinions don't transpose them, if you like, to be the opinions of the listeners. In other words, ask questions that I want answered as opposed to listeners want answered. That's the sort of territory I get a bit confused about, really.
But having been a producer, as you were in a distinguished way for many years, but also a head of department, a BBC cheese, how can you produce yourself? Because up to a point, I guess you have to do that.
And nobody can produce themselves. Everybody needs an executive producer, whoever they are. I mean, you know, I do understand, having been a producer, what's going on the other side. I am sympathetic to the issues. But in the end, I'm totally focused on what I'm trying to do, the next question. There are lots of things I'll miss, and the producer watching will spot. And I think it's a, you know, on the one hand, a presenter has a reasonable ego, and if they've got a lot of experience in the subject matter, you should pay attention to that. But everybody, no matter how good, needs an executive producer. And every interviewer and every presenter needs periodically to be sat down and talked to. Now, do it delicately, respect their ego, but sit down and just go through what they're doing. You could reassure them, but you could also just point out those areas where perhaps if they'd done it a little differently, you know. One of the crucial things about the relationship between a producer and presenter is to create a situation in which you can be relatively frank with each other. That builds confidence like nothing else.
Lucy, that sounds very emollient. Can you have that relationship, which Roger talks about, with, I don't know, a Jeremy Paxman or a Nicky Campbell or, you know, I'm mentioning some names here, but, we've dealt with presenters who are tough. Presenters don't always invite that kind of relationship with us, do they?
Not all the time, but I've managed to massively avoid any of the absolute, I can't say the word possibly, but...
What is that word?
Except monsters, I'll say it for it. Monsters, yes.
Divas.
I'll tell you, there's a good anecdote that I don't think is apocryphal, I think it is true, which is that the executive producer of Top Gear, when he brought on Richard Hammond and James May, gave them a contract, and it was, excuse me, the arsehole contract. And in said contract, he pointed out that at the point in time, inevitably in the future, when they revealed themselves to be arseholes, he would pull that contract out again and show them that clause of the contract. And they said, that's never going to happen. About 4 months later, the first meeting occurred in which the arsehole contract was produced. And I think probably we need a few more arsehole contracts, don't we?
But I think the crucial element is you've got to be empowered by your boss, particularly if you're a young producer. If you're dealing with a well-known presenter, you're a young producer, you have no chance at all if your boss isn't behind you. And I also think it's particularly difficult if it's a one-off show. If you're employing a very well-known presenter to do one-off show for you, it's difficult to build the relationship where you can be relatively candid. But if you're on a series together and if your boss backs you up, I think those are the conditions that it might be possible to have a good relationship. But, you know, in the end, presenters are performers. There is a bit, you've got to be time this correctly. If you immediately after a show say, that was really awful, you've had it, don't do it. I mean, you don't have to say it was wonderful, darling, when it wasn't. But just a little moment of calm, an hour, 2 hours, next morning before you really start to unpeel what went wrong.
Yeah, because they know anyway. The presenter, the presenter would know whether he or she has done a good show. And you don't need to make it worse for them. They need to... And I think Roger's absolutely right. I would never, ever tell a presenter when he or she comes off air, that was shit. You just know not to do that.
On the other hand, if you say, darling, you're wonderful all the time, they won't believe a word you say.
One last thing, because I know you've got to go, Roger. As the presenter of feedback, which is the BBC's primary way of getting engagement, interaction with the audience, does the BBC actually listen to its consumers?
There isn't such a thing as the BBC. There are lots of people and lots of groups who work for the BBC. There are some who get it absolutely, understand. You know, if you're going to have a tax, which the licence fee is, you've got to be accountable to your audience, to your shareholders. So some who get it, there are lots who don't. There are some people who are intensely arrogant in the BBC who think that anybody who writes a letter is a nutter anyway. Why should we bother? There are others, particularly those who have a lot of interaction in their programmes, who pay real attention. I think it's a struggle. And I think, momentarily, there's a lot of people seem to understand it and then they don't. I think it's a shame. I do think what the BBC has to do or ought to do in its training, whatever, is say from the beginning, if you have a licence fee, if people have no choice about what they pay, then you as a producer have no choice but to take your audience seriously and listen to them. Not pander to them, but listen to them. You have to be accountable. The ways in which you're accountable, you can discuss. But this argument that the only people who write a letter, who tries to communicate to you now by email, whatever, is a nutter, is contemptible. I wish I could say that attitude didn't exist in the higher reaches of Broadcasting House.
I think we're all desperate for lots of people to listen to our programmes, for lots of people to watch our programmes. So, yes, you'd be a fool as a producer to take the audience's opinion or the listener's opinion lightly. The problem we have in television with pre-recorded shows that are made months and months in advance is we've got to wait for them to go out on the telly. And only then are we going to find out what anybody thinks of it. So we can't be reactive like you can be with a live programme where overnight you're going to get a lot of feedback.
Do we care enough?
Yeah, I care deeply. I mean, one of the reasons why I left the BBC was because I felt really quite disconnected. And I think that I'm now, I've got a much better understanding of the audience because I'm not in that sort of BBC bubble.
Let's go and see if we can find Laurie Taylor, who's been at the same event tonight.
Well, have you enjoyed it, Trevor? Because you were a producer and a presenter. So what, you know, what have you learned from this experience?
Well, I think I asked the questions. It's my podcast.
Oh, yeah, I know, but so what? It's interactive. Don't you care about
Shall
your audience?
Shall we have
audience?
An advert?
UK-voiceover.com.
Audio production starting from £3.
UK-voiceover.com.
On Twitter, at UK Voiceover.
Yes, so here he is. It's Laurie Taylor. Do they do talent management at Radio 4?
I can remember some years ago somebody said there's going to be a new department of talent management set up. And I can remember wondering, a little vainly, whether or not I might be included within the category of talent. Because I always felt myself really something of a jobbing worker, and talent seemed to me something which exploded across the sky, rather like a Roman candle, rather than the dull, plodding, weekly presenter of a programme. But I can say that I was exactly right, because I've never been approached by anybody from talent management. I've never had a letter from anybody signing themselves talent manager. I've never met anybody who appeared to have any sort of particular control over the over pleasing talent or finding talent or renewing talent or pleasing talent. So I haven't the faintest idea what talent is. I have a feeling that perhaps somewhere in some corner of Broadcasting House there is a talent manager who is speaking to someone who is talented and encouraging them to get on with the work.
Now,
I've never met anybody in the whole of my life at the BBC.
What you are, Laurie Taylor, is a professor. Now, I'm a visiting professor, so that means nothing. But you're a real, real professor.
You didn't need to tell me that. I can tell it by your whole demeanour shouts out, visiting professor.
But what that says about you is that you're an intellectual. You're not a performer. You're not Graham Norton. You're not Chris Evans. You're a person who knows what they're talking about. Does that make it different for you in your view?
I always think there's a sort of slippage occurs because, you see, I'm old enough to remember a comic called Radio Fun. Now, Radio Fun existed at the time before television, and what it used to do was produce comic strips which featured well-known people on the radio, people like Tommy Handley and Arthur Askey, these comedians of yesteryear. But I always remember that it also featured the Brains Trust. Now, the Brains Trust, here was a strip cartoon devoted to a programme which was utterly cerebral. A programme which employed a professor of philosophy called Jode, a sort of anthropologist figure called Commander Campbell, a leading biologist called Julian Huxley, and they used to debate in the most sententious tones deep philosophical problems of the age. And yet they were translated into a comic strip in a children's paper that sold for tuppence and came out every Thursday morning. It always struck me afterwards that professors who went on the radio lost their professorship by virtue of being on the radio. It was assumed that they wanted a little bit of glory. It was assumed they were on a little bit of an ego trip.
I'm going to put it to you, it's the very opposite, Laurie. What they did was they stretched themselves. I mean, my sense of Radio 4 is with, you know, with people like Khalili and, you know, you had a go at Melvin Bragg today, but actually, in our time, it's not about dumbing down.
No, Radio 4,
those programmes are about raising the intellectual level of debate, are they not?
Oh, yes, they are. And I wasn't having a go at In Our Time at all. I mean, I was just simply saying that Melvin Bragg, we know, if we listen, is not a master of all these extraordinarily esoteric subject areas where he goes. Whereas I am assumed, or I, you know, pretend at least fairly well to be a master of most of the subjects I discuss on my programme. So that's fine. I mean, the difference is, I mean, I'm very happy. In Our Time is a wonderfully intelligent programme, and it's gone on for years and years and years. I just think from time to time, I just would like it refreshed with a bit more argument. It always seems to be so bleeding consensual. And I remember Lisa Jardine, who did occasionally sort of take a slightly perverse opinion, was told, so I might be apocryphal, was told by the producer some time ago that she was no longer required on such a regular basis because she was something of a loose cannon. I think it could occasionally do with a few more loose cannons, because it does tend to really reproduce existing scholarship rather than allow academics to argue with each other about the interpretation of that scholarship.
Okay, one final thing while I've got you, Laurie. Radio 4, it is the flagship, isn't it, of intellectual debate and thought and dissemination of ideas. What would you do if you were the controller of Radio 4?
Oh, I would get rid of at least a dozen programmes.
Which well, it's your own problem.
Which I personally... No, there are, I think I've always thought there are two Radio 4s. One Radio 4 is a nostalgic, sentimental, right-wing, comfortable, play it again, let's have more than that, don't rock the boat, here's a nice story, here's a victim to tell you how they managed to triumph over tragedy. There's that Radio 4. And then there is a sort of slightly vigorous, strutting intellectual Radio 4, which is trying to make us all slightly better people, whether it does it by drama or intelligent conversation or insight or whatever. So I'm afraid Radio 4 has always got to straddle those two. The sort of the slightly, not necessarily elderly chronologically, but a sort of elderly in temperament who want Radio 4 to provide a comfort blanket for them. They want to provide stories of resurrection and triumph over tragedy. They want victims to come good. They want music to be uplifting. They want to use it almost as Sonatogen was used in the old days. So there's the Sonatogen audience, and the other audience, how can I characterise them? Let's call them the crack cocaine audience, who want to get a little hypodermic injection of something they didn't know about before.
Brackets Professor, close brackets, Laurie Taylor. Thank you very much. This is the Radio Today programme. Let's have some news now from Roy Martin.
Thank you, Trevor. In the last 7 days, we've learned that Sunrise Radio has imploded. Sunrise Radio 1 and 3, along with the two time stations, are now owned by Leica Mobile. Their reasons for entering the radio industry are not yet clear, but do watch this space. Major developments at Smooth and Real Radio this week, with news expected from Global Radio about the future of the company. By the time you listen to this, hopefully we'll have all the details online at radiotoday.co.uk. And it's Radio 1's Access All Areas Month. A number of features are taking place on air and behind the scenes during the month, including a Q&A live on air with station controller Ben Cooper. Should be a good listen. That's the very latest from radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Roy Martin.
In these days of interactivity with the World Wide Web, make it easy for your listeners to share their voices with you via Audioboo. They simply download the app to their mobile device, record a boo, and send to your station. It's that simple. And just to prove a point, this ad was recorded as a boo and sent in from the corner shop. Audioboo. Sharing voices with the world. Radio
Moments. This week in history was one of consolidation. On the 6th of February 1989, the Miss World group, which owned Red Rose Radio, announced a bid for Piccadilly. It wasn't quite that simple, though. Here's a news item from that day, 25 years ago.
The update at 2 o'clock. I'm Joanna Hartley. It seems likely that Lancashire millionaire Owen Oyston's won his $39 million takeover bid for the Piccadilly Radio Group. His Miss World group seems certain to take over Piccadilly after the radio station's shareholders voted narrowly to reject a planned merger between Piccadilly and two stations in the Midlands.
The foundations for the group, which became EMAP, later Bauer, and the vote which meant that the Midland stations went on to look south, not north. A whole generation remembers those early days of commercial radio with some affection, and one commercial stalwart is 60 this week.
This is Giles Squire, and every day on Metro, I shall have the pleasure of welcoming you to a programme called Just After Lunch, or The Giles Show. It starts at 1:45 and goes through until 4. And during that
a
time,
young Giles Squire there on Metro, hot foot from his days at the United Biscuits Network. Happy birthday, Giles. I said commercial radio there, contrary to a letter received this week in 1979 by LBC. John Thompson, the director of radio at the then regulator, the IBA, wrote as follows. Could you please try to get your folk on air not to talk about commercial radio unless that outdated phrase is needed for reason of clarity in a particular context, and instead to talk about independent radio or independent local radio? Talking of commercial radio, which we really shouldn't apparently, this week in 1935, something famous began.
girls and boys, make your request, we'll not refuse you. We are here just to amuse you.
Early brand integration. The first Ovaltinis broadcast on Radio Luxembourg this week, 79 years ago. By 1939, the Ovaltinis Club had 5 million members, each duly receiving a badge and a book. It's 14 years this week since we lost Robin Scott. Robin ran the light programme and was the first controller of Radio 1.
The BBC's radio continuity, even on the light programme, was at times a little bit like on Radio 3. That is to say, pause, think again, decide what you're going to say, which is written down anyway, and then say it.
Farewell Robin Scott this week in 2000.
Radio 2, Radio 1, go!
It's just a year now since we heard the news of the death of respected Five Live commentator David Oates.
There hadn't been contact or any foul at all. Ball had gone out of play. Noticed a Bolton player lying injured. He was midway inside his own half. Soon became apparent that it was Fabrice Muamba.
David Oates, who died this week last year, aged just 50, he'd begun his radio career on Radio Manchester. This week, 46 years ago, the first ever UK phone-in. The record is held, it's said, by BBC Radio Nottingham, and it formed part of a programme called What Are They Up To Now? Now, we don't have that particular recording, sadly, but here's another very famous early Radio Nottingham phone-in.
And I'm going to talk to the person who rang in right now. And what is your name?
Colin Sampson.
And what do you reckon it is, Colin?
National Anthem of Belgium.
Sorry, Colin, you're not right. In fact, it's... well, I won't tell you what it is, will I? Because we hope some more telephone calls.
Yes.
Whereabouts are you ringing from?
From my home.
And where is that?
Berridge Road.
I see. Well, thank you very much for ringing in, Colin, and sorry you didn't get the right answer, but maybe better luck next week. Thank you, Colin. Bye-bye.
Sure.
Happy birthday to the phone-in this week in 1968. Across in Northern Ireland this week in 1990, another one of those FM-AM splits. Unusual, though, this one, because the Heritage commercial radio brand went across to AM, and there was a new name for the FM.
Good morning, and welcome to Cool FM, the new music radio service from Downtown Radio. Broadcasting 19 hours a day on 97.4 FM. We hope you will enjoy our programmes, which will feature the music and lifestyle of the 90s. It's just gone 8:30.
The launch of Cool. This week in 1924 saw the first airing of this sound. The Greenwich Time Signal Pips, introduced on February the 4th, 1924, at 9:30 at night. They were originally generated from the Royal Observatory.
This is the original six pip master clock here at the Greenwich Observatory. It was used in the 1920s to send the time signals down a telephone line to the BBC at Broadcasting House and then transmitted to the whole country.
Back then, the last pip was the same length as the rest. It was just 1/10 of a second. It didn't go beep, just pip. The first outing was introduced by Sir Frank Dyson, who was the Astronomer Royal, and it was his idea, so he said, "I'm introducing them." He was a bit like John Myers in that respect. Noel Edmonds also used to enjoy talking to the pips.
Oh, brilliant, lads. Well done. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I tell you, Shubby, they could even do it. Speed it up.
I've never seen them working like this. They are working well.
Noel Edmonds, as we say, happy 90th birthday to the pips. So, with dedicated radio licences abolished this week 43 years ago, Mansfield 103.2 launching this week 15 years ago...
It's a great day for Mansfield, Ashfield and Bolsover, the launch of your very first local radio station.
And BBC Five Live Sports Extra launching 12 years ago. Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments.
And that's your lot for this week. Your views welcome as always. I'm Trevor at trevordan.com. Thanks to Joe Coombs and David Prest who organised Rig's Happy Host event. Next week we'll have more on Global's plans for Real, Smooth and, who knows, maybe a new radio brand. And we'll talk to the author of a new book about Radio Caroline. This has been a TDC production. Thanks for listening.